Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen, on this brisk 46 degree Fahrenheit night. I wanted to tell you guys sort of like my regimen for recording these shows as of 2020, December. I work a full day. I eat, hang out with my friends, maybe a couple sets of friends. And then like right now, it's 2:30 in the morning. At one level, I want to be back. I'd rather be in bed, let's put it that way. But on another level, recording episodes is fun, man. If I'm editing, it's that scenario. And then editing happens somewhere during the day around the work. So I apologize if any of you feel like I am not cranking them out fast enough. I have to do 100 per season, right? By the way, we're at 579 videos that have been created for this show. And there's a couple dozen that are retired, replaced. Show's been watched 59.5 years. Our viewership is through the roof in terms of consumed minutes. And like we're consuming minutes now faster than ever before, or at least maybe since like season 4 when things got really jacked up nicely. And our subs are like all over the place, up, down, up, down, up, down. So today I want to impart on you something that's become a catchphrase with me for many years, at least a couple decades, if not 2.5 decades. It's a term that, as far as I know, I made up. There's no accolade there. I just want you to know I didn't plagiarize it from anyone else that I know of. And you've heard me say it maybe a couple times in all these episodes, but I use it a lot in my personal life and I use it a lot in my professional life. If you are a salesperson, whether you be an entrepreneur where you're always going to be your own salesperson or you specifically are a salesperson in some company, this phrase is very powerful if you can describe the concept very quickly and if you can drop it at the right time. It's sort of like the golf clap. When you hit it at the right time, oh my gosh. See, not another teen movie, if you don't mind. Very lewd humor. It's called The Battle of the Promises. We know that this is the way that the world has been seriously corrupted. The Robin Hood, steal from the rich and give to the poor archetype that is usually manufactured by the rich to trick the poor and less educated into believing that's going to actually take place, that they're going to steal from themselves or their buddies and give it to you. All of the liberal celebrities who keep every penny pinched as hard as they possibly can while telling you the normal person to open up your doors to MS-13 murders. Because what could go wrong, right? But what is a promise? I want you to think about this for a split second, because what we do on this show, if you're new, is we slow down time so you can understand your brain a little bit better. Why do you like gambling? Why do you like anything that you're addicted to? Usually it all comes back to a little chemical called dopamine in your system, in your brain. That's why we like drugs. A promise can stimulate a dopamine drop. It feels good. It's an assurance that something's going to occur. And if you're happy about it, then the promise will exponentially reinforce your dopamine. Both from an intellectual, conceptual level without any dopamine. And then when the dopamine hits, it's like, oh. It's like Gary Oldman biting the pill in Leon or The Professional. But now, what do you know about promises in terms of believing them? Let me ask you a question. Do you believe promises more when you're young or more when you're older? I'm going to put all my money on the younger you are, the more you believe promises. Promises are almost magical. They're almost like Disney cartoons, aren't they? And let's just look at the political atmosphere in the world right now. A bunch of kids want socialism because they've believed a bunch of promises from people that have never lived in it themselves, never implemented it. They believe it from the same people who have potentially been in control for decades and decades and decades, but never delivered on it. It's like Maxine Waters coming back to hold her nose as she visits her county because she's so much better than everybody else, and promising them reparations. Well, her dude was just in charge for 8 years, who's half black, and he never delivered reparations. I don't even remember it ever being discussed. Lies, lies, lies. But those are the sort of the basic fundamentals of your personal experiences with liars who promise, with your susceptibility to promises, and your chemical reaction to promises. Now, if someone says, I promise I'm going to get back at you, you're not going to have a dopamine drop, of course. Hopefully you're not in a situation where that becomes something that you hear in your life. But what is the professional version that I guaranteed you at the beginning? At least I'm guaranteeing it now. If you've ever been into a business where you're going out and having to assure a client that you're going to perform on time, on budget, no excuses, and then you don't have any competition, well, then they're kind of like, well, you're the only one that does this, so I guess I got to hire you. But when you have competition, which is nearly always the case, especially as the internet gets bigger and bigger, you will undoubtedly run into a scenario where you're having a discussion. And someone will say, well, we talked to the competition, and they said they would do a little bit more, usually, not a lot more, sometimes a lot more, but doesn't usually happen that much. But they'll do it for a little bit cheaper, and they'll do a little bit more. And so why should I do business with you? Now, the interesting thing about it in America is, I would say when I ran my video game company, and again, my clients were gigantic, you know, we're talking Atari, Yahoo, Marvel, Disney, MTV, Electronic Arts. I mean, the list goes on and on. I'm the chief negotiator. I'm the dude closing the deal in front of everybody else. I had slightly shorter hair at the time. It's so pathetic that we worry about how long someone's hair is to trust them or not, right? But I would get this promise thing where someone had promised the client more than we had initially promised in a vacuum, right? If somebody said, hey, here's the other guy's sheet of stuff that they say they will do and the price that they'll say they do it and the timetable they say they do it, can you beat that? I've rarely ever had anybody do that for me. I'm always the first one, as comedians say, taking the bullet on stage, walking out there to a crowd as cold as ice. You got to warm them up. I believe it was in a negotiation with Yahoo Games that I first used this and saw it, took it from my personal life of just stating this with my friends and then pushed it into the professional realm. And I think if I was a guessing man, I saw the other person's mind immediately approved our gig after me saying this. And we had had a situation where prior to us, a company from Russia who was doing some beautiful work, but as I explained in a previous episode, their coding technique unfortunately trusted the manual, and the manual was wrong. And because of some previous development efforts I have with my company in some really tight spaces, programming video games on cable boxes for Time Warner, we realized that the manual doesn't work when you're getting, because we sensed it. We sensed it. We had no processor, no memory. We sensed it. And so when we got to normal platforms, big platforms with almost infinite memory and disk space, our stuff was super tight. But this guy threw out a bunch of stuff that, again, we had no previous knowledge of. And I said, I just looked at him like, sort of like a grin, like a cowboy looking at another cowboy making a, you know, an unreasonable statement. I put a pregnant pause in there, and I said to him, well, that's the battle of the promises, isn't it? And he kind of smirked like, oh my God, I never even heard of that phrase before. And I said, so I let that sit with him for about a beat or two in the script. And then I said, how's the memory doing on that game that they created? And he kind of smiled, and I said, how's the processor after, say, 10 minutes of running that game with no players in it? Just you running the game by itself, which is supposed to be like a 12-man poker game. And he just kept smiling and smiling and smiling, and he's like, all right, all right. Because they were following the manual, all the processor power was gone, all the memory was gone, and it was just a bug in the Flash player way back in the day. So we sealed the deal. It was the first volley of several hundred thousand dollars. We got us started. So let's say you're in a trade business where you have a service or a product. Services are usually more apt to use this excuse, but you're a plumber, you're a general contractor, you're somebody that does something, and there's competition, and someone's throwing the competition in your face constantly. Don't rush into the phrase. Let it sit in the room for at least a second or two. And just kind of look across the table as from one wise person to another and just say, well, that's the battle of the promises, isn't it? The other thing was that we were in the United States, just 35 miles south of Yahoo headquarters in Los Angeles. There's actually a headquarters in the Bay Area, of course. And I said, look, we're local, man. No translation. We work around the clock. We work 7 days a week. Not because we feel like we have to, but because we like it that way. We'll let you know when we leave town. It'll be after we deliver the product. Now, what's obviously extremely important as a digression in the follow-up of that sort of scenario is you must deliver excellence. Not just your goodest, not just your bestest, but the ultimate. At least on your first project, you need to just knock it out of the park. And we actually created something so incredible that after we delivered it to the client, a producer was able to relaunch the product skinned in a completely different franchise that they had access to, which I believe was the Da Vinci Code at the time, without calling us one time. And so the dude was able to go into his boss and say, you know what, man, we didn't even ask for this. And I was able to skin the whole product without any deep code knowledge, just replacing images using this configuration file. And we got two products for one. In fact, we can do this a million times if you want. And then, of course, Google infiltrated Yahoo and they lost their CEO who destroyed everything. But this battle of the promises is starting to tear up the world. Before this 2020 incident, there was a group of people in Paris that had rioted almost every, or demonstrated, I should say. I shouldn't say riot. They demonstrated peacefully for the most part for a year. It was really causing Macron a lot of problems over there. I'm sure he loves the situation this year. There's so many birds are killing with this situation. It is astounding how brilliant they are in sort of doing a Ned Niederlander shot, you know. I put all these little Easter eggs for you guys. Like, Ned Niederlander, who the hell's that? And some of you are like, Ned Niederlander, he said it. Oh my God. But why were they demonstrating over there? They were demonstrating because all the promises of universal income wasn't working out. In America, approximately 12 years ago, we were fed a huge line of crapola about this medical system that was going to be free. This medical system that was going to cover everybody. This medical system that was going to be affordable. In fact, they even put the word affordable inside the name of the Act, A-C-T. Within a year, every single person knew they had been completely duped. The only people that seemed to not have any complaints are either those that were completely healthy and had lots of money to pay for these gigantic premiums, or people that were sick who had plenty of money to pay the gigantic premiums. A promise that was always a lie. Every time the President of the United States for 8 years talked about this thing, he was lying. Every single time. Try to find a statement that was true, and you won't be able to do it. And yet, supposedly, they want you to believe that there's a huge group of people still following this party. When apparently there was a big rally, or I guess an appearance by the person who is never going to be President of the United States, and 15 people showed up. Oh, but he had a record outcome in this recent event in the United States. There's also the personal act that we've all done in our lifetimes where we are being, I think, irresponsibly held accountable for the future by someone saying, well, can you do this? Can you get it done? Could be in a personal sense, could be in a business sense. But if you live on the cutting edge of technology, like I've done several times with my companies, there are situations where you have to simply say, well, no one in the world has ever done this, so we're going to do the very best that we have. And if you need me to outline all of the variables that we understand and the technologies that would allow us to get from point A to point B, more than happy to chew your ear off for days on end. You know I can do it, right? But sometimes people will want the unreasonable outcome. And not because they're being mean whatsoever. They're not being unreasonable. It's just something that's been typically capable of being committed to in every other type of business model. I'm going to give an example in a second here. So they're used to it. They're used to being able to ask, and then it's all just meat and potatoes kind of stuff. And then when they reach way out of typical reality, they get confused. Now, those technical people and creative people that know me in the Bay Area or Hollywood, or if they live in some other place because I met them in those other two regions, they know that I'm like a black ops guy. You call me to get stuff done that has never been done before. And I mean ever. And usually, I don't think I've been stumped yet. So because of that reputation that I've had for years, I mean, probably three decades, I got a phone call once, and for the OG listeners, this is a bit of a repeat, but it's been a long time. But I'm just going to go at it from this specific perspective of the issue. I had an associate of LL Cool J call me in, I think, 2009 and say, look, this dude's been trying to create an online music studio where multiple people can work online to create a song. I mean, if he had done it for this year, he got rid of the product eventually. I mean, it would have been perfect this year. And there are some products that can do it now, but they don't do it the way that we wanted it to occur. So I get this phone call. I get some assets. I create a presentation. I draw an interface. I go partying with my friend Jessica Chobot and drank too much. And then I came home, finished the presentation, went to bed for 3 hours, woke up, went to the Four Seasons Hotel, sat in this lobby for probably 30 seconds before one of his business managers who contacted me came in to get me. Now, having been a fan of his in my youth, it was pretty surreal. I walk in this room, it's his music manager on the right, and or his acting agency's manager or whatever, and this other kind of business dude on the left, and me. Gave him the presentation, blew his mind. He said, man, this is exactly what I've been looking for. But it was just a bunch of promises. Now, what we didn't talk about in the middle of this presentation was to the extent he wanted this music studio to work. So I go back home. About a week later, I'm at Disneyland with my kid. We just walked in the front door and my phone rings and I'm like, oh, hello. And they were like, yeah, are you ready to talk to Cool J? And I'm like, oh my God, I'm just walked into Disneyland and it was sort of during the day on a Friday. And I'm like, yeah, give me 1 second, you know? And I ran inside one of the stores in the front area there and just hid in the back. And I was just talking to someone in the front. I said, hey, I'm not stealing anything. I just got to take a phone call and I'm not supposed to be here. Or at least I want to give the impression I'm here. And they're cool. So I get on the phone. He says, look, man, I love your presentation. This is great. You know, you're a team player. I looked at your resume, your company, blah, blah, blah. We got hired. So then we start building this product. And then out of thin air comes this very logical feature that anyone would want who wants this to be created. His end goal. He knew he wasn't going to get this right off the bat. We got the prototype done in 45 days. I mixed a song across the United States, which was awesome. But he wanted a group of people to be able to harmonize in three different locations, or however many, at the same exact time. So they could hear each other at the same exact time, no matter where they were on planet Earth. And right away, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you know, maybe with the Douglas Adams sub-ether wave band, we could pull this off. But with current technology, internet speeds, all the choke points across the United States, interruptions in flow. I mean, gosh, you could have it pretty well set up, but someone downloads some big file in that particular location and it just couldn't work. So what we ended up finding out was that during the prototype presentation at William Morse, where we mixed the song, we realized that we were at 30 millisecond delay. He speaks into the mic, to the beat, and it took 30 milliseconds. Now, we didn't know it was 30 at the time, but it hit the mic, runs over the operating system, comes back to the ear port, and goes into his ear, and that trip was 30 milliseconds. The layman didn't notice it. LL Cool J noticed it. He was like, it's off. It's delayed. And I'm like listening going, oh my God, I'm trying to train my ear up to that point. Then we did some math, found out it was 30 milliseconds. And so then we started using other hardware that's more hardware and less software and found out that truly the trip takes about 15 milliseconds, 12 to 15 milliseconds. We had to create a special USB jack that would take the audio down to the USB, give a copy to the operating system, and run a copy back up to your ear. And we had to create a separate Dolby driver for it. I mean, it was tough. But that's just solving the problem at the actual laptop or desktop. And now I'm supposed to achieve this amazing thing over the internet with three or four people. We work on this product for 11 months. It looks tight. It's working well. You can totally do a song together. One at a time. The ear thing works for everybody at that location. All you have to have is a web browser, which downloads the plugin for your headset, and you're ready to go. Your DJ in England drops a track in, you're in LA, you start rapping to it, you're good. But 11 months in, he finds out, after we got sent off on this big journey to redesign Pro Tools into this package, and literally, if we had built this package the way we designed it, it would have put Pro Tools to nap forever. But somewhere on his side of the game, they lost track of this simultaneous recording harmonizing feature. I thought that they had conceded that this was physically impossible in the world. And so I'm called up to his offices off Melrose and La Brea. And he's not happy. And it's hard to see your hero of sorts be unhappy and a client that's good. And we're excited about this project. We don't want to lose this project. But that was the last day we worked on that project. He kept saying that it was the steering wheel to the project to be able to do this harmonization thing. And I'm looking at this other dude who is his business manager, who very well knew that we had informed him that this was impossible and apparently didn't pass it on. I don't think it was malicious or anything. It was just one of those things. And so he and the manager and I went off for dinner after about a three-hour meeting with Cool J. We had a conference call with Cool J in the car after dinner. It seemed like everything was cool. We're trying to figure out what things are going to cost for the next phase. And they pulled out, had some other group finish it technically, which it was already working. I don't know. It had no bugs. All the features were in there. But they went and got some sponsors, and it became a laptop you could buy from Vios, sponsored by Adobe. Changed the name just a little bit. Changed the logo just a little bit, ran for a few years, and then it was over. So it's one of these situations where sometimes people want to hear promises, and they don't hear that you don't promise because they don't want to hear that, and so they block it out, and that's the moral of that story. We made it clear that the speed of light would be necessary to achieve remotely that ability. And now in the last 4 months, I was actually consulting on a project where they're trying to essentially throw some networks across the United States that might be able to achieve this using some dark fiber stuff. I still think that the routers that move the packets around are going to prevent this from occurring, but they're trying to get it as close as possible. So some guys have written a white paper, basically a conceptual paper, that this might actually be possible. Used for all kinds of different things. In addition to the business side of things, because I think this will be helpful for you, especially if you're young and you get into this, you will come in with some wisdom that will blow the minds of the adults. If you are an adult trying to maintain your business and grow your business, this will also be, I think, valuable to you. And a lot of you know what I'm about to say, even though I haven't alluded to it just yet. There's nothing more powerful in the world than setting an expectation correctly. It's a phenomenon. It's really, really strange. You will meet with someone about a particular project where promises are going to fly back and forth. You may never utter the word promise, but a commitment will always be interpreted as, well, you said, When you're a young business person, you're really, really super duper excited about gaining your first deal, and you're almost at the level of immaturity to say, and I've been there, is why I'm saying this, yeah, totally, and you think in your head, there's one in a million chance that will work, but yeah. Luckily, I've been able to deliver. But in that first session you have with someone, you have someone chomping at the bit on the other side, wanting to hear what they want to hear. They want to hear it out of your mouth. And you want to tell them because you want to please someone, usually. If you're a conniving con person, then you're just one of those people and you're going to lie anyway. But you're not watching the show if you're that kind of person. What's fascinating about the first meeting with a client or anyone you're working with, even a friend, a relationship, whatever, is that, in my opinion, they're willing to hear anything. They're willing to hear any limitation that might be a part of the project effortlessly. Well, you know, I don't think we're going to be able to quite hit that. Or if we're going to, if you want to hit this level of perfection, it's going to take a lot longer and take some money because this is the process and you explain it. They're good. They're good with anything that you say during that initial meeting. The other one is to not tell yourself that you're going to solve all these insurmountable problems simply because you need the money. If you lie to a person about their project just to get a check because you can't pay your rent or whatever, I want you to envision sitting on top of a, you know, a pile of dynamite, and then you just turn the detonator and your career is over. Okay, so you get that little check, you get the rent paid for 2 or 3 months, and you will almost never get the check again unless you can change your identity, change your industry, never meet those clients again who will ever talk to anyone else. And with the internet, that's much more difficult. Now, you also don't want to get obsessed with the minutia. I've seen people go in fact, my partners are this way, or my partners in the past have been this way, and it's almost to their credit that they were so utterly honest that they wanted to say, well, maybe not, maybe, well, I don't know, you know, maybe, da-da-da. And part of it had to do with lack of experience in doing the certain type of work that we were doing. They were just being honest. In their estimation, they couldn't see the solution. I had a client worth millions of dollars that we nearly lost because one of my partners was such a nice guy that he was going in, and I saw him in the meeting, and these two guys were saying, you know, we're not sure about your partner over here. He's making us feel really nervous. And I said, okay, well, let's sit down and talk about it. And they outlined what they wanted, and I saw clear solutions for everything because I had been an OG programmer / you know, designer, architect, director, whatever, for really heavy things like EA.com. And so I'd seen this stuff before, and I said, oh, yeah, I think we could do this and this and this. And I remember one meeting, they just turned to me and in front of my other partner and said, now that's what we have been waiting to hear. Sort of indirectly kind of slamming my other partner, like, dude, why couldn't you say that? But it's teamwork that makes the dream work, as Cool J says. Now, the more sinister and negative version of this is what I alluded to earlier, which is that the youth of the world will believe a government body until they are eternally poisoned, fatally poisoned. It doesn't mean that the time of death is going to occur shortly after being poisoned. It is just that they will have a tough time finding an antidote for their brain. What's fascinating about it is that we have comparisons that we can make, which are actually direct comparisons, which don't feel like direct comparisons in my mind. What am I talking about? Well, what I'm talking about is, how many of you believe one religion and you have bumped into someone who believes a different religion? Could be all within one genre like Christianity, and you're a Mormon and someone else is a Jehovah's Witness or a Quaker or a Catholic or whatever. And you guys have completely different interpretations of the Bible. At least you know that they exist out there. And you might even talk like they did in Meaning of Life just before they sang the song, or just after they finished the song, Every Sperm is Sacred. I think it was the Protestants talking, and I believe it was, Graham Chapman talking to Eric Idle, who was playing his wife. I think that's the cast. And he simply said that they had privileges that the other guy didn't have. He had to sell his children to experiments, the other guy, the Catholic, because they couldn't wear a condom. And it's a weird thing when you have been raised in a particular belief system, or even probably more strategic, you weren't raised in one, you picked one, and generally as an adult, and so you absorbed it, and you feel very convicted in your beliefs. And then you run into someone who thinks you're completely wrong, even though both of you want the same exact thing for society and for yourself in general. Sometimes, right? We know that we've had a lot of organized protests. Some of them get crazy. Some of them result in senseless looting and that sort of thing. It has nothing to do with the agenda that's being presented. We know people have been killed. We know buildings have been burned down. Businesses are being destroyed forever. Just read an article today that all those businesses in Oregon and Washington are now receiving their insurance hikes because their buildings are in locations where these privileged white kids go in and destroy everything in the name of a movement that they barely have any grasp of. In my opinion, one of the quickest ways that I woke up as a young man was that the world had this sort of indirect promise that if you did certain things, you got certain things in return. I'm old enough to remember the advice that went out from almost every person in the Midwest, which was find one thing that you love to do, learn how to do it better than anyone else in the world, and you'll never work a day in your life, and you'll retire early, la, 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 la. Even if you end up working for a corporation, you'd work 30, 40 years for a corporation and retire with a pension. Doesn't work anymore like that, does it? It didn't work for me almost immediately after I probably became a teenager. I think one of the simplest things that we have around the world is that as a child, you do not believe that your parents should ever be apart from each other. And what's interesting about it is we don't raise children out of the womb saying to them, Mommy and Daddy are never going to get divorced. Mommy and Daddy are here forever. It is simply so embedded in the utter DNA of mankind that even a baby believes that Mommy and Daddy should be together, at least for all the years that they're at home. And yet the bankers sabotaged that in the 70s when they used the feminist movement to tax both sides of society and break up the home to get the kid inside the systems, watching Al Gore movies as soon as possible, and having transvestites read your kids library books in preschool, including the ones in Texas where the transvestite did a giant pole dancing lap dance for a child while the parents yelled and screamed, hooray. Killing it, man. Killing it. So when I saw my parents get divorced, there was a few reasons that I knew at the time, and there was a few reasons that I didn't know until I was much older. I didn't really have a problem with it because, again, as I've told you, both my parents were very busy people, very into their own lives, and so it was kind of like both of them were the reincarnated twin of, was it W.C. Fields, right? Get away from me, kid. You're bothering me. It was sort of my whole childhood. They'd loop around to kind of like patch it up and then they'd disappear again. It was interesting. And I didn't really care because they had done that to me from birth. And so by the time I was older, it was like I didn't miss something I never had. It made me extremely independent, which paid off in the end. Then as time moved on, I learned that the school systems were completely corrupted. I mean, they weren't balanced between states. Teachers were criminals sometimes and weird stuff. And so you realized, okay, we're all a bunch of little kids in different aged containers. And that really was helpful to me because, you know, at the age of 13, my dad's army buddy told me, you got to raise yourself from now on. And I was like, what? And this dude's like, brilliant guy. Been around the block, man, let me tell you. And so I was like, okay, I'm not sure exactly what that means. I'm not sure exactly what that entails. And I'm not sure exactly why he was telling me that. Although he told me, the opening statement was, I think you're more mature than your father. And not to knock my dad or anything. It was just, I was really serious guy at a young age. And I think that was, my dad's just a very playful guy. And so he interpreted the other side as like, okay, you're a little, maybe an old soul, maybe. I'm telling you these anecdotes because I think that a lot of you probably have your own very similar experiences. In America, we have the American dream, which sort of alludes to the previous example where if you do these things, you'll be successful. And then you learn about boom and bust cycles, the ritual that is about to be upon us if we don't have a major situation. It may be upon us if we have a major situation to correct the situation that just occurred in the United States. So you're born without the knowledge that there is a substrate of control. There's many, many layers to it. The layers increase every single year. You have your own personal battle of the promises. Well, because any one particular day, I'll give you an example. Remember my example about talking to a potential client or potentially a friend or a partner, and you're making commitments to each other. Well, you do this, I'll do that. Okay, great. So you will renegotiate at times life itself with yourself. You wish there was a place you could go to simply say, I'm tired of the grind. I'm tired of doing as visibly everything I can do right, treating people well, being gracious, being giving, both emotionally and financially. You sacrifice, you sacrifice, you sacrifice, and you're waiting for that energy to come back to you. Now, it might be coming back to you in ways that are more subtle. For instance, I make it a ritual to tip people well, to treat people in public really well, and to help my friends whenever I can. Now, I may not get back those frequencies in a way that is recognizable to me, but perhaps the freedom I have to run my own life and be self-employed every single day for the last, 17 years, that is more subtle for me. The return is more subtle for me. You're going to survive. It's going to be tough at times, but without you giving this to the universe and getting back the positivity, you'd be in a ditch by now. You'd be unemployed by now. I mean, you'd be on welfare. You'd be living in someone's bedroom. But because you do put this frequency out, we keep you above water. Every once in a while, you're going to get lucky and something great will happen to you. That's sort of how I interpret it. But I do think that we, at times, feel like shouting at the sky. It's like Christ talking to God and saying, why me, man? Why do I have to die? I kind of like it here. I got some buddies. And Mary Magdalene's looking pretty nice. You know, I do go to these like whorehouses every day. All right. I don't think there's any doubt that if Christ didn't get sacrificed for our sins, that he probably would have married Mary Magdalene. He probably would have. But then you have the next step up, which is probably your friends. You meet in under one circumstance and things evolve. You're probably never on the same track as your friends. And that's why you like them. They have a little something different. You share your side of the world, they share their side of the world. It's a fun experience. But guess what? You don't spend usually every night with your friend or friends, and you don't sleep with them, and you don't, you know, plan your whole life side by side with them. Then you have your lover. Better than a friend. Someone who's got your back, no matter what. Even if you're wrong sometimes, she'll explain it to you later, or he'll explain it to you later, if at all. They usually know that you were full of it at one point. They just let you figure it out for yourself. But now you're going to spend almost every waking day with them, sleep next to them, eat with them, help them when they're sick. They'll help you when you're sick, etc., etc. And then, depending on if you get married or whatever you want to do with your life, you might end up wanting to have children with them. You would love to have a little one that looks like you and looks like them. It doesn't even matter if it looks all like them. You love them so much, to replicate them is only a delight, right? Well, now you're dealing with a child. That's a very interesting experience. You're going to make commitments to your children. How many of you have seen a movie that dealt with the issue of death with a child? Meaning, your child sees a pet die, a grandparent pass away, maybe even a close friend disappears at some point due to some accident. And you have to explain to your kid the concept of death. And it depends on how old the soul is inside your child as to whether or not they go, no, okay, that's a bummer. Or whether or not they're totally freaked out. I think a child that is completely freaked out of death is typically a fairly new soul to the human experience. I was very fortunate to get what I believe to be a very old soul in my kid. She had to deal with a grandmother passing away in her early 50s. One of her best friend's fathers passed away just randomly in his early 30s. I mean, she saw quite a bit of strange things occur. And she dealt with it beautifully. But your child doesn't have any commitment to liking you, besides the biological need to have a mother goose of some sort, somebody to protect them. I think the younger the soul is, the more the child gets attached to the parent. And the older the soul, they tend to be very independent. No matter how much you try to get them dependent on you, they're like, nah, I'm good. I'm good. I love you, but you know, I'm good over here. And it's sort of a blessing in the end when your kid can totally take care of themselves because you worry about them less and you trust their judgment implicitly. But you'll make commitments to your kids, won't you? And you'll make commitments to them when they're 3. About what you're going to do when they're 16 or 18 or whatever. And it just depends on how society unfolds. How many of you have kids? And in the United States, there's a commitment, usually an unwritten commitment, that the parents of the bride will pay for the wedding. I can't remember what the groom's parents are supposed to pay for, but that's just the way it is. And I've known friends of mine that had their kids and they were in the pocket when their kids got married. And so they were able to give their kid, you know, ridiculous amounts of money to have an amazing wedding. And then I've seen the economy crash. The parents lost everything. The daughter wants to get married and there's nothing that can be done. Most kids understand, but some kids don't. And they feel like their parents didn't uphold the tradition of the promise. Usually a pretty narcissistic kid does that, and it's pretty rare, even though they made a television show out of it, I think. And then let me ask you this personal question, which is, have you ever had anyone promise you something, and they totally neglected the promise? They chose to renege on the promise. And as an adult, especially if you're someone who always upholds the promises that you make, or death do you part from your promise, it starts to feel like that B word known as betrayal. Well, in a relationship, what's very interesting that I believe is very, very different from the Stockholm Syndrome we're about to integrate into this episode, and I have a whole episode on Stockholm Syndrome. I don't know where it is, but it's out there somewhere. It's on the website, deepthoughtsradio.com. Use the search field. When a government lies to you, especially your political party, there's a fascinating thing about that. If a person is casually engaged in their political party, they will usually switch parties if they are lied to because they don't have a huge attachment to the party and they haven't showboated their party to their friends. I am this and I'm better than you, right? When a person does the inverse, they showboat the fact that they're a particular party or they're part of a particular movement. And then they realize that movement is actually against them and not for them. A lot of them slip into what we call Stockholm Syndrome. Now, for those of you who don't know what that means, it means that you have fallen in love with your captor. And Stockholm Syndrome is something that is usually categorically the case when someone has been captured as a prisoner, whether it be child trafficking, human trafficking, or prisoner of war. You have no choice but to fall in love with your captor if you want to have a moment of peace in your soul. You will tell yourself that your captor actually technically cares about you. And you'll cannibalize very incidental things like, well, I'm still alive. They bring me food, even if the food's horrible. It's insane how far it can go. Torture can be actually interpreted as a positive and not a negative. Some people will think, well, I must be a bad person. This is why this is happening to me. So thankfully, this person is punishing me for whatever I've done wrong. They must be smarter than me because they captured me. They're dominating me. And so I just need to take it. There's a whole bunch of this going on right now because there's a whole bunch of parties that have lied to their people. Now, there's another factor involved with this when it comes to the technical theme of breaking a promise, because that's what these individuals find out with a lot of these parties. Now, I did an episode quite some time ago where I mentioned that I had watched a series of videos, probably 12 videos, an hour apiece, roughly 45 minutes to an hour with commercial breaks, I guess, although the commercials had all been cut out. And it was a series on TV about how third world countries are dealing with the toxicity of corporations in their backyards, as well as trash disposal for each and every country in the world, and how people pick the trash to find food, to find electronics, to find copper and various elements that will sell, gold, all that kind of stuff. And inside this, there was a point where they interviewed a gentleman who broke down the mental mechanics of a human being that has been completely depleted of what they need. And they drew a very interesting snake-eating-its-tail correlation with this process. What they said was that the rich in the world waste resources because they can. They destroy the world because they can. We see it every day, don't we? The poor and the destitute and the starving, aka feral human beings, they do all the same things because they don't have the mental aptitude in that state of mind to care. They're just trying to survive. And, you know, you might be going like, what do you mean waste things? People who are broke typically use every single piece of the buffalo. Not true. I saw one of the documentaries about the, I believe it was the Romanians in Russia. And it was just a small group of Romanians, probably 50 to 60 of them. Not sure what the count was. These people had struggled for a very long time. So the state continually attempted to upgrade their worlds, move them out of ditches and ghettos, and they got a bunch of really nice subway cars and built the mountainside with homes and all this other stuff and put them all together in this one lot, kind of like a sanctuary city. They bought them TVs. They bought them game units. They bought them all kinds of places to put the refuse and have it picked up on a timely basis. But within a few months, they realized that these Romanians had sold everything that they were given for money to get their things like cigarettes and other addictions. The trash containers that were dropped off were then also sold, and they threw all the trash into this hillside down to this ditch. Okay, it's simply because that group of people lacks the bigger picture. Instead of grabbing them and educating them and really treating them to the world as it exists, they left them in an uneducated, poverty-stricken state and then gave them things to try and put a button on it. And in this documentary, which was very interesting, they had a Romanian doctor who had grown up in those type of ghettos who had become an amazing man. And they asked the guy, he said, well, what do? The town had spent $6 million on this tiny group of people in about 10 years. And I know that might, and that's a ton of money. I mean, like any one of us with $6 million could last easily. I think probably one individual could last 60 years with that kind of money, right? 100 grand a year, especially in a place where nothing costs anything. The guy just shook his head. He's like, I don't know. Education is the only thing. But if the parents don't endorse the education, which was one of the big things that the kids never went to school, and this is all over the world. This is from Uganda to Brazil, to all these different locations. And I'm sure it happens in every one of our countries. I don't mean to pick on anybody. Promises. Very interesting dynamic for the human mind. You know, it's you'll have a situation without a promise necessarily, that someone has made a commitment to you. Now, in my opinion, a commitment runs a bit like a calendar in your computer. You can put an event in your computer to happen one time, and it comes and it goes. You go to your meeting, you have your conference call, whatever it is, and you never think twice about it. When you sign up to a think tank, which I've done several times, you have a weekly meeting at least. If you're on the board of directors of the think tank, then you'll meet with the board two or three times, while not with the major group, organizing what's going to be talked about, moving, you know, the marker forward. It's that repetitive, ongoing commitment that's very similar to the formula of the Garden of Eden. The problem with the Garden of Eden as a story, as I've mentioned a few times, is that you essentially have two people that are imperfect put in a perfect place with one perfect rule. Because a rule is perfect, isn't it? God says, don't eat the apple from the tree. Everything else in this Willy Wonka factory you can suck down every single day. Just don't eat the apple. Well, they also weren't said to have any age limits, and so Adam and Eve were going to live forever. And my side analogy for this is a pool table. You have a ball, a cue ball, and that's it. And you try to line up the cue ball such that you can hit it. It will go around the bumpers on the edge forever and never go in one of the six pockets. I think you can talk to any pool parlor person and you'll probably find out that's really tough to do. If there's the slightest imperfection in the ball, slightest imperfection in the felt, the slate, the wood that the felt is on the edges, that ball will change its trajectory, CD home. At some point, it will go in one of the pockets, eventually. It might take 1,000 years, but it'll make it in there. So to have God suddenly blow his top the second that Eve eats the apple would have to be a much bigger plan to teach them the before and after or something. And of course, the story demonizes women, which is why, if nothing else, I categorically reject it. But this is sort of what happens in our personal lives, isn't it? We have commitments with our partners. We have commitments to and from our employers, to and from our children, to and from our friends. And it is an impossibility to uphold all the promises. Even if you take a contract from a potential client, you actually need to put inside your contracts, especially after 2020, an act of God clause. Could be defined as an employee passing away. Could be an act of God like 2020, where even if it's propaganda-based, it doesn't matter. It's affecting everyone. And the way I think that you can enjoy life a whole lot more is to tell yourself, if you're doing any business with anything other than a machine with infinite power and a lack of any type of flaw that could be achieved, which is pretty much every machine on earth, but usually machines can outlast human beings, depending on what kind of machine it is, human beings will always let you down. And it's not because they're disappointed with you and they're retaliating. Oh, that does happen. Betrayal happens. Selfishness leads into betrayal. I got a whole episode on betrayal if you want to listen to that. But as you're, because there's two sides to the coin in all cases when it comes to a promise. There's the person who's receiving the promise and the person who's making the promise. You will be on both sides of the coin several times in your lifetime. I know that sounds trivial. But then again, these are the elements of existing as a human being that absolutely no one seems to be talking about. If you bought a self-help book, you're probably going to get less content than you will get in this one episode. If you bring it up to a friend, they'll get some statement, some catchphrase or something. Life's a bitch and then you die, man. Suck it up. And that can work for a little while until you really need something and you need people to uphold their side of the deal. And for whatever reason, they either won't or in a lot of cases, I think predominantly, they can't. And it's disappointing. One of the things that's happened to me as just a kind of a ridiculous example is that I used to be very shy about, I shouldn't say shy. I was too prideful to take unemployment if I ever ran into that. And it wasn't, I didn't even hit a remote unemployment realm until 2013. And what I would always do is spend my savings first and then go on unemployment. That's a really stupid thing to do. Always do your unemployment first, and then your savings is when that runs out. Because if you go the other way around, when it's over, you're really hustling. And there could be something healthy about that too. It's time to get rolling, baby. You don't need more money. It's funny how we always seem to find some way to make it happen. So for me, I was trying not to milk the system, even though I've paid hundreds of thousands of dollars into the system and only made back a fraction of that. We don't need to do that. The other one is in the expectation realm. When you're in a situation that is fraught with obstacles that you've never dealt with before, or you've dealt with them before, but they're not as severe as the ones you're dealing with now, which I think is a very timely topic for this year, it's important to continually communicate with everyone who could bail you out, everyone that could help you out. If it's nothing more than just referring you to a client, referring you to a particular job, you need to let them know that your clock is ticking down, you're going to need some help. You need to just, at one point, make it very clear that you need people to engage as opposed to just simply listening to you, because they will naturally always listen to you, naturally. But a lot of people have never helped another person in any significant way. It's not that they won't. It's just they've never done it before. And so in their brain, there's no instinctual thing to go, well, I've helped a lot of people. Let me just talk to some buddies of mine. I'll get you a job. Once you've done it a few times and you feel the euphoria of helping another human being, it will become your addiction. And then you'll lose sleep because you can't help a friend. I will say this just as a footnote to that. Many of you already know this, but sometimes just a kind word, a pep talk, can be the help that they need. That's why I try to do it every once in a while in shows. I've mentioned in the last by 6 months, individuals that seem to be willing to sell out their own people in my country, just instantaneously. They love the promises that things will all be better. They love it. They're addicted to it. And the archetype of promises is very interesting, because within a promise is an anatomy. The most appealing promise to a young person in this day and age, because parents don't raise their kids to appreciate a job well done, this satisfaction you feel at the end of the day when you put your head down on the pillow, like, man, I kicked it out of the park today, man. Killed it. Feels good. I did twice as much as I thought I would get done today. The promise archetype of today is that you can be lazy, do nothing, and enjoy all the spoils of life. That is the archetype of today. But what is that? Well, there's a few sayings, right? No such thing as a free sandwich. If it seems to, you know, too good to be true, it probably is. We've lost these little sayings in society. No one is telling these kids at their parental level, because think about it. Nearly every kid who is acting badly in 2020 has a parent that they communicate with, a friend they communicate with, who's potentially older than them and has this knowledge within them, but they forget to say it. And so this idea of like, oh, come on, man, just come out there and help us destroy all these buildings and burn these things down. Yeah, you know, we'll kill anybody who doesn't like what we say. Because in the end, we won't have to work. We're going to get this universal income. Dude, you know, I got it all planned out, $1,200 a month. I can live in this shack, never work, never have any self-respect, never accomplish anything in my entire life. Yeah, we'll get fat, we'll play video games, smoke dope, be awesome. That has been the archetype of how almost every nefarious thing has ever been introduced into legislation. Now, we also know that there's the stealth methodology of using a promise to move something into legality that is very bad for everybody. Examples. I don't know what they call this in Europe, and I would actually love for one of you to chime in on this to any level of detail you can for me. In America, when we go vote, there's because we have 50 states, we have the state vote, and then we have the federal votes. At the state level, and especially at the community level, we have these things called propositions, which we abbreviate and we call props. And they're given numbers every single year. So Prop 1, Prop 2, Prop 3, whatever. Goes up forever. These propositions were taught to me in probably the last 15 years to be all taxation. No matter what you're voting for in a prop, usually, and there's some exceptions, you know, gay marriage was one that wasn't a tax. The other one was whether or not to allow legal immigrants into California was a prop. Didn't really come with, I mean, that comes with taxes, but that's just going to be taxes anyway. But they will write the text of a proposition to read like the biggest promise you've ever heard in your life of just the euphoric existence. If you can just make this thing happen, it's going to benefit every human being on planet Earth. Hell, it could be a proposition stated strictly for California citizens, and they'll try to convince you that the other 49 states are going to benefit from it. Usually, categorically, 99.9% a gigantic lie, which is why when another elder taught me the actual sort of common denominator anatomy of these things, he said, never vote for them unless you like taxes. And so from that point forward, I've always marked them no. And the interesting thing is every time one passes, in fact, there was one in California that was aimed at increasing the taxes on car gasoline. I don't believe, I was at a restaurant and these two girls who were in their 20s, very SJW kind of girls, were talking to each other and they were disillusioned afterwards because they said, oh my God, that made my car registration go up. It didn't actually make my gas go up. Car registration in California starts at a 10% the value of the car. I mean, just do your math, man. It's huge. But it goes down a lot every year. So what I want to get into your brain, to highlight in your brain, again, I'm not trying to get you to follow my religion, but just remember that promises are insinuated in so much of our communication with each other. A commitment. Even though, and what's strange is when you're a kid, a commitment is supposedly like a lesser promise. A commitment is usually, well, if it's convenient, I'll keep my commitment to you. What's interesting about that word is that when you're in a relationship, typically, the at least one of the partners wants it to be monogamous. You don't go sleeping around with other people. That's the commitment. And that commitment is always interpreted as a ironclad promise not to break that rule. But how many times do we have these commitments with people? Yeah, hey, will you help me move? Yeah, sure, man. And they find out the Super Bowl's on that day. You know, sorry, man, I'm back. I threw my back out yesterday. I'm going to barely be able to watch the game on the sofa. Go down to the bar and get me a drink to ease my back pain, right? And so things fluctuate. So we talk about, I talked about earlier, you know, this whole idea of setting expectations in a client, and that the way it works is that the client will take anything that you say. You can say, I can't do that, I can do this, and they're completely fine, non-emotional. But the second you sign the contract, and it's in the list of milestones and the definitions of complete, which is very important to put in a contract, so you can not argue with your client about what is complete, they will blow a top if anything goes different than what you set as an expectation. Okay, well now let's point that at ourselves. How many times have you heard some sort of motivational speaker sort of talk about you and yourself being a contract between yourself and yourself?